With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to the CapEx podcast. I'm John Ashmore, the editor of CapEx. Since leaving the EU, the Department for International Trade has been a flurry of activity, with dozens of EU-era agreements rolled over, new bilateral deals signed, and others in the offing. Among the biggest prizes, however, would be signing up to the Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement on Trans-Pacific Partnership. Now, if you haven't heard of CPTPP, it's a trade bloc currently made up of 11 countries, including Japan, Australia, Canada, and Mexico. It might sound counterintuitive for a rainy island in northwestern Europe to want to join a trade bloc centred on the Pacific, but it actually makes very good sense, as a report this week from our parent organisation, the Centre for Policy Studies, makes clear. For this week's episode of the CapEx podcast, we welcomed one of the contributors to that report, Anthony Magnell. Since his election in 2019, Anthony has been the Conservative MP for Totnes, and he sits on the International Trade Committee, poring over the finer details of those post-Brexit trade agreements. Joining Anthony is economist-turned-journalist Soumaya Keynes. Soumaya is the Britain Economics Editor at The Economist, and until recently co-hosted Trade Talks, a podcast about the economics of trade. Who better, then, to talk us through the ins and outs of the CPTPP and what it might mean for Britain? So, Soumaya, Anthony, thanks very much for being on the CapEx podcast. We'll dive straight in. So, the Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement for Trans-Pacific Partnership. Anthony, you wrote a piece in The Telegraph earlier this week describing it as a slam dunk for Britain. I mean, how big a deal is this for the UK in both senses of the word?
Well, CPTPP is a huge deal for the country because it is the first significant trading bloc that we can join after leaving the European Union. We are signing trade deals at a rate of knots and we're confounding expectations in this area. But CPTPP is the biggest bloc of trading countries that we want to be able to try and join. And it is going to have a significant share of global GDP. And that to us is a real, or to me, is a really attractive place to join.
Mm-hmm. So, as an economist, I mean, what are you looking for when you look at these kinds of deals? Obviously, the UK hasn't actually joined yet. I mean, is the percentage of global GDP that a bloc covers the thing we ought to be looking at? Is it value adds? I mean, what sort of stats do you look at and think, right, those are the important things?
Yeah, so the I think the Department for International Trade did an impact assessment of, you know, looking at the effects of joining the CPTPP, and they didn't find astronomical effects on the UK economy. I think it was something like, was it 0.08?
I think 0.008, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. Zeros, okay, well, we can...
no, 0.08, sorry, you're right.
We can argue about whether it was a small number or a very small number.
A tenth of a percent, basically.
Sure, yeah. So I think we're all kidding ourselves if we think this is going to light the UK economy on fire. You know, with that kind of framing in mind. I mean, clearly this is a very important deal politically, right? And I think it's politically important for both sides, right? You know, as just mentioned, there is this desire for the UK to be this buccaneering free trader, signing lots and lots of deals. The CPTPP would be a significant new deal that, you know, the EU was not part of the CPTPP. Lots of the deals that the UK has been negotiating are effectively rolling over the EU's old deals. This would be a new one, so that's a big deal. And also, I think it would be politically interesting for the CPTPP members, as it would really move this deal from being a regional bloc around the Asia-Pacific to more of a global deal. They could prove that they can include a European partner.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. I mean, Anthony, there are 11 signatories as it is. I'll just very quickly run through them for our listeners. They are sort of from west to east: Vietnam, Malaysia, Singapore, Brunei, Australia, New Zealand, Japan, Chile, Peru, Mexico, and Canada. So it's already an enormous geographical sort of swathe that it covers. And what is a Western European country doing trying to join this group of countries?
Well, I mean, Canada is obviously also a member of it. I know it bridges both sides of it, but and Ecuador and the European Union members, I think an EU commissioner only last week said that the EU should consider joining it. I think it's about global trade. I think it's about, we can talk about numbers, and I actually just want to touch on this, is that you're absolutely right, you know, that it is a small number of initial value joining CPTPP, but the point is that trade deals aren't static. They evolve and grow over time, and it's not just about numbers in terms of GDP. It's also about the agreements we can get on environment. It's also about the benchmarking we can get on digital trade. It's also about the defence and development agreements that we can get, all of which I think are part of global Britain's ambitions. You know, we have to use global trade to counter some of the forces that are going to destabilize the world, to contain the Chinas, to find ways and solutions through some of the most intractable problems that the world faces. And trade has always, through history, been a benefit to doing so. So, you know, I think it's right the UK is looking to do so. And of course, we're going to be the first country to join that new bloc. And obviously that, to me, is pretty exciting, but actually it offers that opportunity for us to play a key role in that region, as well as be a pathfinder for other countries who are wanting to join.
I mean, how do countries in a bloc like CPTPP exert their influence if it doesn't include China? It's the sort of elephant in the room. You have the largest economy in Asia by far, the second largest economy in the world. I mean, how significant can it be if it doesn't include them in it? I mean, they wanted to accede originally, I think, but then decided against it.
Yeah, so it might be worth just going back to look at the history of this deal. So it started out with a group of Asian countries wanting to essentially rationalise some of the trade deals that they already had between each other, but also create this very high standards agreement. And then the US, under the Obama administration, was essentially looking around for something to achieve its strategic interests when it came to China, right?
Yeah.
And so then the US kind of joined and it became this very important strategic vehicle for writing the new rules of the road, right? It would be a way to, you know, put the mark in the sand and say, okay, China isn't in today, but this is the direction of travel. This needs to be the direction of travel, because over time, the idea was that the US would agree a trade deal with the EU, and then maybe at some point in the future, everyone could join together in this massive, massive agreement and essentially agree new rules to overcome the problems associated with there being gridlock at the World Trade Organization, which was the kind of is supposed to be the main forum for agreeing new global deals. So the point wasn't so that there's always been a kind of problem with CPTPP, right? Which is that the idea was that you would write new rules and eventually China would sign up. The problem is that there isn't really a mechanism for getting China to sign up to these new rules. You know, the important rules are rules on state-owned enterprises. I don't think anyone thinks that China's anywhere close to meeting, Western rules on data or also
intellectual property is another one as well.
Yeah, I mean, China's made some improvements there, but still pretty far away. So there isn't any mechanism for bringing China on board, and that kind of, we can talk for hours and hours about this, but that frustration was part of why the Americans kind of walked away from it and now are not reconsidering joining it. They're kind of using other mechanisms. And so there is this question of how effective this thing can be in getting China to sign up.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't disagree with you on any of this stuff. And I think it is interesting that China has indicated recently that they're sort of thinking about joining. But the reality is they're never going to be able to meet the standards and the expectations to be able to join that group. But the other thing that is interesting in the region is the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership Group, which does have China in.
You preempted my next question.
I'm really sorry, you can go back if you like. But like, and I think what has been interesting in the report that we've done with a sort of a policy studies on this, looking east, is the fact that when we were talking to other countries and ambassadors and trade experts from different countries, there was a big effort for them to say, actually, we want to look at diversifying our supply chains. We want to be able to create a block of commonality in how we approach things. We want to look beyond the World Trade Organization, as already been said, because there is so much gridlock and deadlock. And I think that offers the opportunity. But I still look at the countries that are indicating their willingness to join, from Korea to Thailand to Vietnam to now Ecuador. Who knows if the Americans will ever be able to get over those hurdles? I suspect not for the short term, because they've got some clauses that they took out of the original agreement of the Trans-Pacific Partnership that were frozen out. They're very unlikely to try and join the CPTPP without asking for those 11 clauses to be included, and we're unlikely to agree on those. So, you know, it is going to be hard to see some of the bigger players joining in the short term. But if you can get the smaller players in the region and you can diversify those supply chains, you can diversify the way in which we benchmark standards, provide an alternative to the World Trade Organization, there's real value to it.
Hmm. But I mean, Anthony mentioned RECP there.
RCEP, yeah.
My question is a slightly technical question, is how do these things interact with each other? So Peru and Chile, for example, are members of Mercosur. Mexico and Canada are members of NAFTA. Oh, USMCA,
yeah,
sorry.
Yeah. So
I should recap that.
Maybe
it's
yeah,
been
yeah.
renamed,
the
USMCA.
So it's RCEP and then the USMCA.
RCEP and the MSMCA. You can tell who's the trade expert who isn't here. So, I mean, yeah, how does membership of multiple trade blocs affect the way that these things work?
If you're a company, then lots and lots of different trade deals is a bit of a nightmare. Essentially, what you want to do is let's just think about trading goods for a minute. You want to make a product and you want to know that your product will be sellable in as many different countries as possible. And what you don't really want is lots and lots of different rules for each country. Right, so it does make sense, instead of having 8 different bilateral deals with various countries, to have one deal which says, okay, this is the amount of content that you can have from your country and the region for it to qualify for these lower tariffs. So there is a kind of rationalization objective. It does really make sense to have as many countries in an agreement as possible, because also from a kind of purist economics perspective, really what you want to do is avoid discrimination, right? You want to avoid, it's very inefficient, it's annoying, you want to avoid this kind of faff of not sort of having to contend with all these different regimes. So the trend over time, in the 90s, early 2000s, there was this big trend of this surge in smaller, narrower bilateral agreements. Mm-hmm. And now there seems to be more of an effort to try and rationalize those into bigger deals. And that does make sense. But of course, the more countries you have in the group, the harder it is to get consensus, right? So that's the limit on that.
I mean, Anthony, what's your view on the balance between the UK striking lots of bilateral trade deals and being part of these kind of blocks? I mean, our strategy since leaving the EU seems to me to have been to trumpet the number of individual different countries that we're signing deals with. But would it be more significant for us, economically and diplomatically, to just join a few bigger organisations? Or can you walk and chew gum at the same time?
So as has already been said, I think you're absolutely right. Like, the rollover deals are basically irrelevant. There's no change to them. That we shouldn't hype this up. We should really be talking about the new deals from scratch. The irony in trying to join CPTPP is that we're already doing bilateral agreements with some of the member states ahead of time. So, for example, the Japan agreement was a rollover agreement, but we expanded it to actually include more on digital trade, some of which actually I think, and I'm just not good enough on the detail on digital trade, I'm trying to get up to speed on this, but some of which is truly groundbreaking and can be a global benchmark. But the Australia Free Trade Agreement that we've got now, we've got the documents, those on the International Trade Committee like me are now busily reading through the 2,000 pages and turning to experts trying to get a better understanding. That's great that that's come out, but we're going to see New Zealand. We've now got a digital partnership in the offing with Singapore. We're already sort of signing bilateral agreements with quite a lot of the members of CPTPP, and I suspect You know, you're going to see this in the same way with the Gulf cooperation community, which we may want to do something immediately with the bloc, but we may have to start with immediate bilateral agreements to get to that process. I don't think it is slightly chicken and egg, because whenever I've spoken to experts in Australia, New Zealand, Canada, they're always saying, no, it doesn't have to be a bilateral agreement first. But actually, it does seem to me that this helps oil the wheels to get us into that block. So I think, I'm afraid, for our trade negotiators, for our experts, for our analysts, there's going to be a lot of reading, a lot of work, because we're probably going to end up doing both.
Mm-hmm. I think there are some really interesting negotiating dynamics here, right? So if you're a member of the CPTPP, then what you want to do is kind of all gang up on the UK, right? You want to all negotiate as one big block. You know, the UK is clearly quite keen to join this agreement, right? There's a political imperative as well as an economic one. And so, you know, you're stronger together. And whereas the UK might want to sort of try and go bilaterally to kind of set precedents with each member to sound out how those bigger negotiations might go. Now, I'm an analyst, I'm not a trade negotiator, so I'm sure someone will tell me how what I've just said is complete rubbish and actually want to go for the big prize at first, but that would be one way of looking at it.
It's really interesting. Crawford Faulkner, who's advising the Department of International Trade, says, you know, the key indicator of a successful trade deal is when both sides are pissed off. And, you know, I totally agree with you. I think, you know, there are, in the bilaterals, there is an opportunity for us to get something right on the minutiae, to do something that we can then use as an example. And this is one of the reasons I've always argued in Parliament that we shouldn't be worried about bilateral agreements always being rolled over to be similar in every instance with other countries. More often than not, I don't think they are. I agree that a bloc has a great deal of power over us when we want to join, and we're very keen. You know, being overly keen about this is not a great negotiating tactic, especially when people like me are writing reports with the team from CPS. But it does seem to me that at the moment the bilateral agreements are preceding any of the more in-depth negotiations and conversations that are being had on CPTPP, and that does offer us an immediate stepping stone and advantage.
Yeah, I just want to pick up on something we Sumaya said earlier, that it was as to do with kind of geopolitics as just pure economics. And how do you see the balance there in terms of, is it signalling to China that other countries are, you know, willing to join together against them in some sense?
I mean, I think we've got to be careful here, because we are always going to have some. We're always going to have a relationship with China. There's no, you can't isolate China in the 21st century. And a few months back, and it's really colloquial and simple, but they came up with a sort of three C's, which was compete, contain, and challenge China. And I think this is part of containing China and trying to elevate the standards. And if we can get it right, we can, as I said at the beginning, you can diversify those supply chains. You can offer countries like New Zealand, which are predominantly dependent on exports to China and Chinese money coming in. We can offer them an opportunity to look in a different direction and to have a bloc that they can rely on. And I think that's valuable, because the value to the Chinese state is to always have a growing middle class. If that doesn't continue, then that has a problem. And the last bit on this is that, from my point of view, is that this is also perhaps the answer to the one belt, one road sort of policy. And I think it kind of brings together like-minded nations, as much as they can be when, you know, Singapore and Brunei and the UK, you wouldn't necessarily always think they're completely like-minded, but there is a real advantage for having the same outlook on trade, for the same outlook on digital, the same outlook on environment, the same outlook on geopolitical, which I think many of those countries do.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Now, can we just zoom out a bit to the kind of general global trading picture? I mean, you both talked about kind of gridlock at the WTO. When Liam Fox went to be the UK nominee, or tried to be the nominee, he complained a lot about how little progress, how barriers were going up. I mean, if you were from a free trade perspective, are you kind of optimistic about the picture at the moment, particularly after what's happened during COVID?
It's hard to be optimistic about the World Trade Organization shaking off all of its problems and becoming a kind of vibrant forum for new rulemaking. And that's, you know, I think a lot of the time people frame that through US-China conflict. Actually, the problems are kind of much broader than that. They're really, really difficult to solve. You've essentially got a bunch of developing countries who think that they should get concessions from richer countries, and richer countries don't think that they should give them. And that doesn't exactly pave the way to a grand bargain. So I guess I'm not particularly optimistic about the WTO. There's another problem, which is that the WTO's system of solving disputes is kind of broken. That the UK's position seems to be kind of okay with that for now, at least. I think the future for the trade environment is going to involve a lot of muddling through, right? We've kind of lost the framework that we had that was set up in the mid-1990s.
Is this the GATT?
So the WTO was formed in the mid-1990s, and it was the successor to the GATT, the GATT, okay. The General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. So we've lost that framework, and obviously there's been a lot of tension between the US and China. There are a lot of trade barriers between those two countries right now. Trade relations between those two countries are not being governed by the rules of the World Trade Organization as they were before Donald Trump arrived. But I think the rest of the world, we haven't actually seen properly, you know, there haven't been equivalents to US and China happening elsewhere in the world. So it's not the case that we've just descended into anarchy, right?
That's reassuring. It's great.
So, you know, one shouldn't sort of claim that the end of the trade world is nigh, but it's also quite hard to be optimistic.
I'm really with you, and I'm really sorry that, you know, Liam Fox wasn't successful in his bid to be Sec-Gen or whatever Director General. But no, she is, and has got a huge task ahead of her to do this. And I agree with you, because I'm not particularly optimistic about it either, but I'm not particularly optimistic about many of the plurilateral bodies that are in existence, from the UN to the WTO. But I think, you know, we've got 18, 20 minutes into this interview and we haven't mentioned the pandemic. The pandemic has clearly shifted our view and our way about how we trade, and about, you know, even from vaccine creation to distribution. And I think this has had an impact on the way in which the UK, and way in which countries in general, think about producing, exporting, and doing that, and being able to trade amongst its groups. I agree about the point on dispute mechanism as well. This is going to be a real problem until we can do it. I mean, ultimately, Donald Trump and China have done an enormous amount of damage to the WTO. And it's, you know, I'm not saying it's equal, but it's pretty equal how much damage they've done. And until we can find something that I think perhaps provides an alternative, I happen to think that might be CPTPP if more members join. But of course, more members mean more discussions, which means more disagreement. And maybe this is just a self-perpetuating problem that we face wherever we go, but we've got to try, haven't we?
Do you think the sort of profusion of regional things is a response to that failure at the WTO, or is it some of it precedes that?
No, it's absolutely a response. I mean, there's been gridlock in the WTO for a while now, and you know, I think for a while there was, we're getting really into the weeds of trade policy here, but for a while there was a frustration that some members of the WTO weren't the multilateralists that say the US was, right? So the US would claim that, you know, its priority was getting agreements at the WTO, right? Meanwhile, loads of other countries were just going off and agreeing bilaterals and creating all this complexity that was inefficient. But then, eventually, the US worked out that no, it's really, really difficult to get beyond this gridlock, and that's, you know, the TPP, as it was then called, was part of that strategy to overcome that.
Do you think we've drowned your listeners in enough acronyms on different trading bodies?
I think we should publish a glossary with this. I mean, I've fallen foul of a few acronyms already myself, so, you know. I mean, Anthony, in terms of, you know, your party's economic agenda, how big a part of it is trade, really, compared to reforming the domestic economy?
I mean, I think it's huge, but I also think there's a huge, there's a massive lack of understanding about trade deals. And I, you know, I hold my hands up to this as well. You know, I didn't expect when I got elected that I would end up on the trade committee. I mean, I did put myself forward and ran a fearsome campaign to get on it. But it's been a steep learning curve because obviously you've got 650 MPs who are deeply concerned about a free trade agreement, say, on the impact of their fishing industry or their farming industry, two things that are massive in my own constituency. Yeah. And we've got very little time to be able to impact the direction of the negotiations as MPs, just as backbench MPs, and we have very little time to be able to scrutinise these things. So, you know, the question is how much, and we'll see with this when the free trade agreement with Australia is laid before Parliament, and we have 21 days to be able to scrutinise it. Well, we've got 21 days to be able to scrutinise it. We can't change anything in it. There's nothing we can do to change it, and you wouldn't expect any Parliament to be able to have that prerogative. Certainly it doesn't happen in the Canadian, New Zealand or Australian parliaments. But I suspect what you'll find in that first debating session on the Australia Free Trade Agreement is that people will suddenly start picking out more and more of an interest in trade, and it will become much more of a topic of conversation. And any minute now we're meant to get the agreement with New Zealand, or at least the agreement in principle with New Zealand, and you know, it's going to go on from there. I think, you know, our trade negotiators are moving at pace, beyond expectation, I might add.
Yeah, and one of the things that is mentioned in the CPS report that we should all read is that there's a lot of kind of scaremongering and myth-making about trade deals. I mean, every time we sign or about to sign a trade deal, the NFU comes out and suggests that we're all going to start eating Frankenstein foods. Or in the Australia deal, I think there was a tsunami of beef was going to come onto this shore. I mean, how much do you think of, Simone, how much do you think of that is just pure special pleading? And how much is a legitimate concern about standards being lowered and us poor consumers having worse quality stuff?
Yeah, I mean, trade negotiations are political things, and the response to trade negotiations are political. It's difficult to disentangle legit kind of concerns about competition and concerns about unfair competition or competition that actually consumers won't like. So I would say, so just picking on kind of farms and food standards, you know, this is one area where just getting into the weeds of the CPTPP. So one of the huge battles between Europe and America over food regulation has been over the precautionary principle, which is about essentially the burden of proof, right? Mm-hmm. Should you have to prove that something is unsafe, or is it, should you allow trade unless you can prove that it's unsafe, or should you allow trade
only if you can prove it is definitely safe.
Only if you, exactly, yeah. Yeah, okay.
Which is a very, very high
right,
burden,
and so right? So the European approach is that we only trade it if we can prove that it is safe, right? And so the kind of the debate about food standards, you know, you can pick out examples where you know, American negotiators will say that the British or the EU stance isn't science-based. And I guess what you need is kind of a sense of where the British public is and where they want that precautionary principle to go, right?
Right.
And so, you know, I think there's a legit, you know, you can kind of argue both ways. I have my own preferences. And I think it's kind of important not to assume that the British public wants to go one way or the other, right? I think, you know, what you were saying about a learning curve, right? We're still really feeling out these processes. You know, Britain's kind of just inherited a lot of regulatory capacity that previously had been done at an EU level, right? In some sense, we kind of need to work out what our regulatory preferences are on a bunch of things, right? And this is a really important one.
I'm so pleased you're saying this. I mean, actually, there are two areas that, firstly, when we come to our negotiating objectives ahead of starting any agreement or discussion with another country, we need to be much clearer about where we're going and what we want to see in the process of those negotiations. And we haven't really had that, and it's a big annoyance to us on the committee. I mean, the two things that come up time and time again are chlorinated chicken and hormone-injected beef, right?
I was about to say, yeah. How do you sell that to the public?
Well, you see, the thing is that to even allow it to sell into the UK, you have to change the SPS standards, and that requires a vote in Parliament. SPS stands for, and just because we can't go on with these acronyms, is sanitary and phytosanitary standards, right? There is no chance that any of the trade deals that we sign, and not that an America trade deal is likely to be forthcoming, it's much more likely to be at a state level with the UK rather than at a federal level, there is no chance you're going to see hormone-injected beef or chlorinated chicken in the UK and in its markets because our domestic laws don't allow for it. And to change that, there has to be a vote in Parliament. And there's just no chance that any rural Conservative MP or any rural Labour MP or SNP member of Parliament or Lib Dem member of Parliament is going to vote for that. So I think we've got to be clear about, you know, there are some special pleadings from various organisations, but there is also a need for government to be able to listen to them, because in certain instances, you know, I think the NFU have got certain things really quite right, and they've actually informed us about things that I don't think we're on the table beforehand. So it is important to get that. Just when it comes to the safety element and all of this, you know, I want consumers to have choice, and I want to make sure they're also safe. But, you know, we can look at labelling, and DEFRA is doing that at the moment. But the flip side to this is that most of the time we look at these trade deals, we only talk about the impact of the imports. You know, I represent an amazing part in South Devon. I have some of the greatest farmers, of course, we all say this, but they produce fantastic beef, right? That beef is in demand around the world, and it can be in Australia. And the fact is that I talk to my farmers about the export potential, and I think DIT, the Department for International Trade, has done a really good job in actually picking up and recognising they need to help people export. And I think we have to look at trade both ways, as it says on the tin, make sure our farmers, our producers, our food and drink manufacturers recognise that they can export their produce, and we can help them do that. And that has a benefit too.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked a lot, and you're right that certain things sort of hog the conversation when we talk about trade deals, especially agricultural stuff, because it's very easy to imagine. It's always supermarket shelves. But I mean, Samir, how much of this debate, is it slightly illusory to talk so much about goods when we're such a service-based economy? Is it simply because it's much easier for most people to kind of visualise, I mean, as a journalist, as an economist turned journalist, especially, you know how important it is to turn sort of abstract concepts into something that people can grasp?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely easier to write and talk about goods. The trade barriers to goods tend to be, you know, tariffs are easy to talk about and they are common to lots of goods. labelling, product standards, those kinds of things. Services is much more bitty. The trade barriers are really, really tedious. They are specific to particular industries. This podcast is great. Service trade barriers are really annoying. They're no fun to talk about. They're no fun to negotiate, and they're really, really hard to negotiate as well, because, you know, tariffs are often essentially just put up there to restrict trade. Non-tariff barriers, so restrictions on trade and services like qualifications requirements or other services, trade barriers, they're often put there for a reason that isn't just restricting trade. Right. Mm-hmm. There's, you know, you don't want someone who's completely unqualified providing, you know, medical services or something. And so those kinds of trade barriers are really, really difficult to dismantle. And if you look at even in the single market in the European Union, one of the deepest trade agreements in the world, the single market in services is not complete. Right. I mean, it's better than anything else out there, pretty much, but it's not complete. Right. And that just shows you how hard it is to have comprehensive coverage of trade and services and trade deals. Right. So the CBTPP has kind of more services than your average agreement in it. but in general, trade deals tend to be more comprehensive in terms of reducing trade barriers on goods, which is one reason why they get a bit more focus. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I mean, Anthony, just to finish this off, because I know you have to run back to Parliament, such is an MP's life. I mean, how optimistic are you that the UK will be successful in its application? And when might we expect that to actually take place?
Well, I mean, we're already underway with the sort of the initial stages. But of course, because we're the first ones to join, it's newfound territory for us. Listen, I am optimistic that we can join. I think, you know, we know this because we've signed agreements and bilateral agreements, or we're in the process of coming up to it with agreements with so many of the members already. So I think that's a pretty positive indicator. And all the countries that are there, they're very keen for us to join as well. I mean, I hope we're going to see pretty good progress this year. I think for me, the most important thing going forward is making sure that we're learning from the experiences of the Australia and New Zealand free trade agreements. We're learning from what we've done with Japan. We're learning from our free trade agreement with the European Union. We're learning all the time to make sure we can shape this up and get it right, because it is not, you know, it's not a quick fix and it's not a quick win. Just as we started off talking about the numbers, right? If we don't view trade deals as static and view them as evolving agreements, you can find a way in which you can continually add value. And I think that's something that we need to make sure our negotiators know, but we know as members of the public and as politicians and as experts and analysts.
I would say that we want to be the first to join, but there are other countries who would also like to be the first to join.
I think no one else, though, is at the stage we are at, despite having indicated that they'd like to join. I mean, and also one of the aspects of the report we also focus on is the geopolitical angle. And, you know, what happens if Taiwan, which has now indicated again that it wants to join, you know, what happens in these scenarios? It's going to be a really interesting organisation, not just economically, but geopolitically.
All right. Well, this one clearly has plenty to run and run. Anthony, Sumaya, thank you very much for joining us on the CapEx podcast. And we will see you next time for an interview with Martin van der Weyer on his new book, The Good, the Bad and the Greedy.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.